I'm Lori Jones, President and CEO of Avasec Communications and host of StrategyCast. Join me and my guests, innovators, disruptors, and visionaries as we explore bold and brave marketing strategies that help you transform, scale, and grow your brand. Today's episode of StrategyCast is absolutely unmissable. I am joined by the renowned business strategist, Mark Emmer. And he's going to help us crack the code on integrating sales, marketing, and strategy. Mark unpacks the secrets behind converting strategy into results and discusses the game-changing potential of AI in transforming marketing strategies. And what is the difference between positioning and differentiation anyways? We're going to dive into that. Don't miss out on these expert insights to level up your marketing game. And don't forget to check out the most recent issue of Strategy First newsletter on strategycast.com. Just like this episode, it's full of inspiration and a ton of ideas that will elevate your strategies and marketing know-how.
A competitive edge starts with strategy, and strategy starts with knowing how to develop one. StrategyCast is a leading marketing podcast that serves up strategic insights, trends, and tips to help separate your business from the pack. Tune in weekly as host Lori Jones interviews bold marketing leaders who have priceless wisdom and are willing to share. Each episode explores cutting-edge approaches that have proven instrumental in transforming brands into industry trailblazers.
Welcome to StrategyCast. I am so excited to have Mark Emmer join the show today. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you, Lori. Good morning. And I just want to wish a happy new year to all the marketers out there. I wish you much joy, prosperity, and higher conversions this year.
Oh, I tell you, that sounds like conversion might be a key word for people. I was just doing some strategy work this morning on our own business. And one thing that we always do is we come up with that single word each year to kind of lead the way, lead the path. Conversion, I bet, is a word for a lot of people out there. We're definitely going to dive into some of that today. We're going to discuss the collision of strategy and marketing. Before we get there, Mark, tell us a little bit about your journey. And you are an incredible strategist at heart. And really what led you to that part of business and marketing?
Sure. Well, I founded our firm in 2002. We're a management consulting firm specializing in strategic planning. And we've worked with over 200 companies who've entrusted us to help them accelerate their growth and cultivate their culture and build a sustainable competitive advantage. But in terms of our marketing journey, you know, our approach to it is through very authentic thought leadership. I've delivered about 400 keynotes throughout North America, and I blogged for Forbes, Inc. and the Vistage Research Center. So for me, the best marketing is just being intellectually curious and kind of sharing what I've learned with the rest of the world.
Well, I tell you, I had the pleasure of being in the room with you Q1 of 2023. That's how we met. And the insights were so tangible for me that you shared at that retreat. That it was an incredible takeaway. And I felt that we absolutely needed to share those insights with our audience, which is what we're going to do today. So explain why there is a collision happening between strategy and marketing.
Yeah, well, first of all, let me perhaps share a definition of strategy, because I think it can be a convoluting term for a lot of people. I define it as the difference between your current state and where it is that you're trying to go. But I think the struggle in a lot of organizations is strategy is defined as a set of goals and objectives that the management team pursues, but they're really not a path to any kind of sustainable competitive advantage. So, you know, I think there is an opportunity for marketers to do more than marketing tactics and perhaps have greater influence and be more present in the creation of corporate strategy. So in my mind, the role of marketing should be to champion the discussions around things like customer insight and demographics and psychographics and product development and positioning and value proposition. But I also think that they need to have more of a seat at the table in terms of the company's overall corporate strategy.
I completely agree with that. And there's so many discussions out there today on the lack of seats that CMOs and really the CRO title right now that's taking over a marketing title sitting at the board table. You work with a lot of these CEOs. I'm sure you push the need, but why are they saying no to a marketing seat at the table?
Well, I think part of it is strategic planning really is kind of a two-edged sword, right? So we look outward and we think about what products and services we want to sell in what markets. And you would certainly think that marketing always has a role in that conversation. But part of planning is also looking inward and thinking about the capabilities and capacity that you need to build within an organization so that you could take advantage of those market opportunities. So I draw a distinction between what a lot of marketing folks refer to as strategy, which is really marketing strategy, and corporate strategy, which is more all-encompassing in that. So I think it's very important that as marketers that, you know, we're thinking as you know, strategy being in a more holistic type, thinking of strategy in a more holistic way.
I could not, again, agree with you more. And I think a lot of times what happens is the product team, the C-suite, the revenue team, they come together. And as you said, they establish the goals and then they say marketing execute or sales execute. And without the right objectives, without a clear vision of really what your position is in the market and where you can go from a product standpoint or a solution standpoint, not the marketing standpoint, it truly does set marketing up to fail. Which I think is one of the reasons why there are not as many seats in the boardroom today for marketing is because that front-end business strategy is not what it needs to be, and it does not set the plate for success. So all too often, what is happening is that the C-suite will say, okay, we need to achieve this year, and it might be a revenue goal. But it's impossible for marketing to succeed with that because they've got to back in a plan and they don't have the details needed to implement or to set the table correctly for the audience to be inspired and react.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Because what should happen is first, the leadership team should do an analysis of their market and of their competition, and they should decide what investment is required in order to reach a certain revenue goal. So that's why, you know, the management team needs to do that in a more holistic way. I think another pain point for a lot of marketers is, you know, I work with a lot of larger private companies, let's say $100 million and up. A lot of their marketing folks come from public companies where the goal is to go after the largest addressable market. And if you're a $50 or $100 million private company, you probably need to serve a smaller segment than that if you're going to achieve any kind of market leadership, right? So I think private companies need to think about growth very differently than large public companies do.
Yeah, I agree. I love that point. Do you find in those situations that, you know, regarding addressable market, that automatically people are saying to themselves, okay, here is this competitor. We need to challenge this competitor versus challenging something. So are we challenging someone or are we challenging something?
I think it's more identifying a market need, especially one that's underserved, right? I would say that what happens very often is, again, companies are oriented to going after the largest addressable market. And I would suggest what would better serve a lot of marketers is to actually chunk the market down. So I'll give you a great example. 5-Hour Energy was a private company. They didn't have any private equity funding or anything like that. And they entered a very large market, the beverage market, which was dominated by Coca-Cola, Pepsi, Monster, and Red Bull, who sponsors two Formula One teams, right? Like, these are companies with very large marketing budgets. But instead of taking them on head on, what they did was they chunked down the market and they found a segment that they could dominate. So they came up with a concentrate and they served it in, they offered it at the check stands at convenience stores instead of in the grocery aisle where all the slotting fees and that type of thing are. So I think sometimes if you're a private company, you'd be much better off trying to chunk a market down and segment it in a way that you can achieve market leadership.
That is such a great example. And the thought process of just thinking differently, it sounds super trite right now, really trite, but that is where product positioning, not in the mindset of the role that it might have from a competitive standpoint, but really where you can gain traction in store, helps marketing set the table for success. I love that.
Agreed. I mean, let's face it, marketing's part art and part science, right? So we do a lot of math when we're thinking about addressable market. Part of it is really gaining that unique insight about the more disparate segments that you can serve.
Yeah. And you have worked with incredible brands, incredible leaders throughout your company history. And one thing that you've seen quite often is this friction or this confusion, if you will, between strategy and positioning. Can you provide your insight and some pearls of wisdom there, please?
Well, like I mentioned earlier, I think there has to be, you mentioned a collision between strategy and positioning. There also has to be a collision between what you are trying to accomplish in the marketplace and what your internal capabilities are, because a marketer could go back to a management team and say, I think we could win here, but the level of investment might be so great that, or it might take so much time that a management team may not commit to that level of positioning. So I think it's having a more balanced approach to looking outward into the market and also having an inward look into what a company's capability and capacity are.
Right. You know, we work with some enterprise clients, but they're far, it might be like a single channel that we're working on, something very, very vertical for them versus an integrated approach, which is where most of our entrepreneurial, startup companies, later stage startup are positioned. A lot of what you're talking about requires a lot of research, which cannot be implemented until some good funding comes to the table. What advice do you have for our listeners today that might be earlier stage on what they can do to implement some of the research and the strategy work that you're talking about?
Yeah, the irony of your point is even the, I would say, very expensive market research is imprecise. Market research is almost always imprecise. And there are a lot of tools out there, you know, if people are willing to do the work. I was working with a company once who was in the kind of container cardboard POS kind of business, and they were in Southern California. And they said, well, we don't really know what categories to address. We don't know what our customer segments are really buying. And I asked them, I said, well, do you pay attention to what goes through the local port? Because they were close to the port of Long Beach, which is the largest port in the country. And they said no. And I said, well, you know, all of that is in the public record. And so we went through this exercise where we started pulling all the shipping manifests, and we could see, you know, Samsung was shipping X units of this electronic part to this customer on this date, you know, and sometimes you just have to get creative. The U.S. government publishes a ton of data about basically the market size for most of the major NAICS codes in every city in the country. So I think if you're really willing to roll up your sleeves and do some work, whether it be primary or secondary research, I think there's a lot of data that can be gleaned. And what I would impress upon people is I would rather have data that's 70% accurate than no data at all. So that's what a lot of people do, is they just kind of give up and stop looking. And I do think that there are data sources out there if you choose to be creative.
That's some great advice. We were working with the Colorado Department of Transportation years and years and years ago on a safety campaign to increase seatbelt usage. And the data coming out of NHTSA, National Highway Transportation Association, was not great. Mm-hmm. And we felt that it was actually far lower a percentage of seatbelt usage than really what the state or lack thereof that the state was telling us. So we went and sat on corners of off-ramps on highways, and we just did tick marks on the number of people in a car and then the number of people that did not have a seatbelt on. And you know, it's anecdotal data, but we did it for several hours on several different off-ramps. And what it told us, our gut was absolutely correct. Seatbelt usage was far lower than what we were hearing from the feds. And moreover, it was very, very different by demographic profile. Female.
Yeah. I think what you said is very important. And sometimes what you can do is you can use data to supplement your instincts. I just think you making decisions on instincts alone can be very, very dangerous. You know, I also had another instance recently where I was working with a financial services firm and their trade association had incredible data. And, you know, with a lot of the market sizing kind of information, we're really looking for things that are directional. And one thing I think is really important to understand that's directional is what markets and segments are growing, right? Because when markets are growing, they will accept price increases and new competition. When markets are flat or in decline is where we have all of the price compression and margin erosion and commoditization. So, you know, those are the kind of data points that we're always looking for.
And I think that's where strategy and marketing really become very, very important, because a lot of brands lead with price either purposefully or organically. And if they can differentiate themselves with innovation or customer service or quality or something, anything different, then they can either charge more or get out of the fray of the low price leader.
Yeah. And as it relates to the startups, I think a trap they fall into a lot is they're also looking for perfection. Yeah. And I think in that first phase of a startup where you're just trying to get the product right, you know, it's important just to find one or two attributes that you can hang your hat on that are differentiated and do them really, really well. And honestly, the market will give you a pass on a lot of the other things. You know, I can think of lots of startups over the years, you know, that I've had less than perfect experiences, but they did things no one else was doing, and they certainly were able to gain enough traction till they got to that second phase where they really got the product into distribution. So, it certainly is a process.
It is. And your point brings up a question, and that is, how often do you feel category strategy is one of the only things, you know, a new product nobody's ever seen before as a solution? And even, you know, you can see it with enterprise companies when they totally have to reposition themselves in the marketplace. Sometimes they will, develop a new category strategy and relaunch. What is your gut reaction to category strategy and its impact on business?
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. I think, especially if you're a startup and you don't have a lot of funding, you know, don't try to boil the ocean. Right. Maybe pick a smaller segment, maybe that's underserved, and, you know, hang your hat on one or two unique features, you know, instead of trying to have an end-to-end solution, which might be too aspirational, right? It takes a lot of money to get there. And then, you know, maybe set your eyes on, you know, with your second or third round of funding, is where maybe you're developing the full, like, cradle to grave kind of solution.
Own one market, then move to the next.
Something like that.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. We think that's important as well. So we're talking a lot of research today as well, and AI is such an incredible discussion that is taking place out there, and it's transforming a lot of go-to-market strategies. It's transforming a lot of strategy work. It's transforming marketing implementation. What is your POV on this very, very large and complicated topic?
How much time do we have?
I know.
I have a lot of thoughts. First of all, of course, AI is revolutionary, but it's also evolutionary, right? These are technologies that have been in play for maybe 10 years. But what was distinctive last year about ChatGPT GBT was it was so accessible to all. So I think what we're seeing is a lot of, you know, AI as a service right now. So there are a lot of tools that are already in play. People are using things like AI models and AI video, and they're probably using something like Seamless AI or Wiza for databases, or they're using ChatGPT, or before that, they were using Jasper for content creation. So there's a lot of tools out there, but all of that's kind of current state. I want the audience to imagine a future state with AI where, you know, say you're a commercial real estate agent and a prospect comes to your website and the bots in real time go out and they know who that prospect is. And based on their gender and age, they will create a custom landing page. Maybe the font size, maybe the font colors are different for that person. The bots will go out in real time and understand, well, this person owns a commercial center in Colorado Springs and a residential building in San Antonio, and their credit score is 721, and will build a custom offer for that prospect. So I think the real promise of AI is that I've been saying for some time, digital transformation is hyper-specialization. So with the tools today, more so than any time in history, we have the ability to segment the market and then understand the disparate needs of every prospect and customer, and then deliver the right solution with the right message at the right time to that prospect. And that is a very powerful idea.
Yeah, I think it is too. And what you're talking about is personalization, specialization, all of that. And a very, very hot topic among marketers today. I spoke about this very topic with a couple colleagues at Denver Startup Week, as a matter of fact. And I think what is happening out there is that people are confusing personalization as it relates to product enhancement and interacting with a company. So for instance, my United app, right now I can go there. I know precisely when my next flight is, if it's on time, what my rewards are. And then I get on the plane and I know how much time is left, you know, on my flight, where precisely we are. It totally customizes everything to my need versus marketing personalization. And it, in my point of view, it has to start with the strategy. It has to start with the product, the solution from a personalization standpoint, and then move to marketing. And marketing, yes, we can deploy AI from a research standpoint to gain understanding and insights on customer need and wants and wishes and stuff like that. But it's starting, people are using it as a crutch, and they should be using it far earlier from a strategic standpoint.
Yeah, agreed. And I think the noise for a lot of people is they think that AI will require them to offer kind of infinite options. And, you know, what I've been preaching for some time is customization is not a very scalable idea. Standardization is kind of a commoditized idea. So what we've seen prevalent in our economy for many years is more of a form of mass customization, right? You go to the model homes and there are three models, and depending on which model you pick, there are a number of options, but any of the options you choose are profitable to the provider. So I think that will be one of the things that AI will further enable. It's just an acceleration of things that are already omnipresent in the economy, is allow the customer to choose in a way that's very unique to them, but also provide a platform that is very profitable to the provider.
Right. Yeah, I agree. It's all about experimentation right now. Mm-hmm. And it is a fun time to be in marketing and in strategy development, because utilizing AI, there's so many case studies out there on what you can do from a competitive analysis, what you can do from a positioning review, just all these very, very unique elements that provide you data a little bit more quickly. But what is missing is context. So you still need to evaluate. You still need to take a look at it. You just can't put the information in and spit it out and go to market. It needs the intellect, the context, the human touch, in order to make it make sense and be viable.
Yeah, all of that's true. But the other thing I would say, I think marketers are pretty good at this generally, but we're going to allow, AI is going to enable much better testing, right? You know, if you buy something at e-commerce today, everything is A/B testing, right? Tested. They're testing the image, the offer, the discount, the time of day, the path that the client takes to get there, all of those things. And I do think as a profession that we could be even better at testing, and AI is only going to help us do that better.
I agree. Back to the importance of research, right?
Right.
So what this is also leading to are a lot of new and innovative types of strategies that are emerging. Share some insights there, if you would.
Nice. Well, like I said, I think the sea change that's happening right now is AI is being democratized, right? So there's a few things I see. Companies will be shifting their IT departments so they can do more custom app development. That's something that's already underway. I think we're going to see a lot more of what we refer to in strategy as recombining. So recombining is taking tools and products that already exist and then packaging them in a new way. Wow. So, you know, Uber kind of did this, right? They took some technology that would probably existed like in the airline business before. And there were drivers and there were cars. They just presented it in a platform that did not exist.
Right.
You know, I think one of the things that's going to happen 5 years from now is mobility will be a service, right? There will be some innovator out there, some Uber type disruptor will come in and they will say, okay, well, it doesn't make sense to own a car anymore. Why not share a car and your license includes a bus pass and a train pass and access to a scooter when that makes sense? So depending on what your needs are for the day, the product will bend and morph to the needs of the client. So I think AI is going to enable a lot of what we refer to as recombining. The other thing that I'm kind of seeing in our economy, and this isn't specific to AI, it's just a general trend, and it's also not a new trend, is we're going to see more vertical integration, right? So a company like Tesla that makes almost everything themselves, they have access to better analytics than if they were to sub out some of that work to another company. And that's not just a big public company thing. We're seeing lots of that with private companies. I have a construction client. They have a huge 3D printer. And if a customer wants anything from a staircase to a piece of art, they can actually produce it for them. So, you know, we're seeing a lot of trends like that. And the end game, having the analytics, is going to create a lot of movement and solutions like that.
Well, I love a lot of what you're sharing here. And I like have this sneaky suspicion that you might be working with a great, great company that's going to solve the mobile issue downstream, or you should just go find it and provide them that solution. And as we speak, Uber announced this morning that they've got Uber Flight or Uber Airline or something like that, where you can just get on and go someplace if you need to. That is a neat concept. And for as low as $100 a seat, which is probably, an across town flight, but nonetheless, some real innovation still taking place in that space. So one thing that happens all the time, ultimately, when Avocet hits the table, and we're doing a lot of marketing strategy development with some good strategy at the forefront, sometimes not. But there's always this friction between sales and marketing. And there absolutely needs to be more alignment in order for success to happen. Share insights or your point of view on that, if you would.
Well, I think customers are becoming more fickle, discerning, impatient. And, you know, one thing that we really saw kind of at the tail end of the pandemic, and especially last year in 2022, was a lot of customers their decision-making cycle times were elongated. People froze. And that really gave an advantage to incumbents, and it was very difficult for people trying to win new customers. There's a great book out that I recommend to all sales and marketing people called The Jolt Effect, J-O-L-T, The Jolt Effect. And they point out that a lot of our marketing narrative today is based on this like fear of missing out, which is relevant before a sales call. Right. But after a sales call, the kind of fear that the client have is more of the fear of making a mistake. And if you kind of fuel the fear of missing out with that messaging, when their fear is something else, you actually make things worse. So the point I'm trying to make is, I think even more so than any other time in history, it's very important that sales and marketing be integrated and that they're working in concert so that they are delivering the right messaging from the time a lead is acquired to the time that there's a sales call and any of the kind of touches after a sales call, all the time to all the way to the time that the client's converted and even after the client is converted. So to me, sales and marketing need to be one entity, and they need to be working in concert to agree on messaging, sales scripts, technology. I mean, with today's tool, again, this is just current state. There isn't any reason why business developers should not be able to go into their CRM, pick a communication, a white paper, a case study, or testimonial that's written for a particular customer segment that lives in the CRM, click a button and send it to the client, because them and marketing have already agreed on the messaging in that segment.
Yeah.
Where, you know, what is actually happening is salespeople are feeling like they need to produce that marketing collateral on the fly. So then they send a message to the Make It Pretty department. And you know, that is not a cohesive sales and marketing kind of ecosystem. So that's what I'm advocating for, is we build it for each. And again, I want to repeat this. You need to have different marketing collateral, including a custom landing page for every segment that you are serving. So for a lot of our clients, that might be, say, a market vertical, but your segmentation might be something other than a market vertical. But either way, there isn't any reason why sales and marketing shouldn't build it together.
I completely agree. So is ego the issue?
Yes. But I'd also say, you know, honestly, we build corporations this way.
Yeah.
You know, when you, this is maybe not a marketing example, but it does further the point. You know, if you hire a CFO, that person's job is to protect the corporation from risk. And you hire a salesperson, their job is to expose the company to more risk. So when we put people in boxes, what we do is we create silos. So I think that management teams need to work really hard to ensure that sales and marketing are not siloed.
Yeah, I completely agree. I just love our conversation so much. And I am one of those people, as I'm having a discussion, like visuals are just happening, you know, around me. It's one of the reasons why I don't sleep a lot at night, because it's like I've got these visuals and I'm like waking up. And as you're explaining all this, I'm seeing, you know, the master strategist, the Yoda of strategy, working with these CEOs and these C-suites and putting incredible plans down to be implemented. And then it gets handed over to marketing, or get handed over to sales or product, you know, HR, whatever it might be. And you're like, no, that's not going to work. What are some of the pitfalls that marketers need to be aware of once the corporate strategy, the business strategy is handed over? And what have you seen that you would tell our audience never to do again?
Yeah, the answer is actually embedded in the question, because I really struggle with the idea of handing it over. So hopefully, as we discussed earlier, sales and marketing have a seat at the table in the strategy formation. A mistake, a cardinal sin in my mind that a lot of companies make is there are the corporate types that build strategy and then they try to punt the execution to other people, where in my mind, the way to form strategy is in working groups. And those working groups, to me, this is the biggest mistake you can make in strategy, is showing up to a strategy meeting without any preparation.
Right.
So working groups should be working before the strategy meeting to coalesce around data. They're building information that is presented in a strategy meeting so that a management team can make informed decisions. And then the very people who were in the working group that brought the data and helped create the strategy are then also the champions of the initiatives that are born out of the strategy meeting. And so that's done in concert in such a way that execution is clear and what you're trying to accomplish in the strategy is clear because you have the same folks that were involved in the strategy and then in the execution of it. Now, that being said, in every organization after strategy formation, there's a cascading down of goals, but you have to have a structure to do that well. We use OKRs in our firm, which of course is objectives and key results. And that's a good methodology to make sure that the goals are clear and that they're cascading down throughout the organization.
I love that. And it's, that hand in glove approach to a good culture anyways, and really setting people up to succeed versus fail, which I think is a real important part of the DNA of any organization.
Yeah, you know what's amazing? I'm so impressed with the success of our clients. And I always say it's not because they hired us that they're successful. It's because they're successful that they hired us, right? So strategy is a form of humility, right? So it is not typical that executives will include a group of people in strategy formation because unfortunately, a lot of them want it to be about them. It's their ideas, and they'll often make decisions in a vacuum. They don't trust the team around them,
right,
to help in strategy formation. So I think that those executives who are humble and they show up in a way where they want to be inclusive of other ideas, they're the ones that build the best strategy. So those are also the kind of people who will bring in a strategy facilitator to help.
Well, they're the best leaders, hands right. down. I mean, they've just got a different thought process. The DNA of that mindset is very, very different. And I think when you get to that enterprise level, at the startup level, there's kind of like that e-myth, you know what I mean? It's that, I've been making cakes for, Betty's Cake Shop. I can do that. And the myth is that the entrepreneurial mindset is right there. They've got the business prowess to make it happen. And then they soon realize, oh, that's not for me at all. And I think once you get to that level of really understanding culture, leadership, success, and surrounding yourself with a team that can create that success with you, you're not just the head of the body. The entire company is there to help you along, and everyone shares. It's that shared success as well. I think that's when you see the exponential growth that you're involved in.
Yeah, that's so well said. And look, the e-myth is my life, right? What happens is companies grow to $25 or $50 million dollars, and then they need to jump over into the next revenue strata. And what happens is they reach the ceiling, they get stuck. And it's exactly for that reason. It's also known as the innovator's dilemma, right? The founder gets out of bed one day and they built this sizable company, and all of a sudden they need a controller or a CFO, and they need a CRM or ERP and whatever, and their head wants to explode. And there's too many moving parts. And it's at that point where they really do need strategy, but they also need to bring in legitimate C-level talent. So for me, there's a direct correlation between maturing startups that jump in the mid-market and the quality of the leadership team. So if you just have a controller, he or she might be great at managing your books, but she's probably not going to manage your bank relationships or integrate an ERP or do those things that companies do once they grow up. And you know, eventually you really need to have that CFO kind of person. So, and the same thing holds true in all the other corporate departments.
How often do you see that founder saying, okay, I need someone else to do this, or the investment bank or VC dictating it?
You mean the executive or a strategist?
The change in position, you know, hiring in the paid C-suite at that stage versus the founder remaining. I mean, there's a lot of heartache at that stage, and it's usually the founder being pushed aside.
It often is. And I would say the answer to your question is all of the above. You know, it's when the founder starts to surround him or herself with advisors that say, look, you need to have professional management or you can't scale this business any further. It's a scalability problem.
Right.
So at some point, the successful founders cross that chasm, and the ones that don't, they kind of fizzle out.
Yeah. You have this incredible background, incredible experience. You've worked with dozens, hundreds of companies, really helping them grow and scale and move to the next level. Can you share an example with our audience today on one that we may or may not know about that is just a real passion for you, something that you really like to talk about?
Well, this is a tough question for me because since we work with private companies, you know, I don't kiss and tell.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm reflecting on, you know, your original questioning talked about the intersection between strategy and marketing. What I would say happens quite often is that we work with the management team on the corporate level strategy, and then some marketer comes in and they have the sizzle, right? And they do a great job of communicating the value proposition with words that even the management team can't come up with. So here's a good example. We've been working with a very successful B2B company for about 15 years. They're sizable. They have around 2,500 employees. And, you know, it was through a whole series of corporate decisions that they decided that we want to remain independent, even though our largest competitor is public. And we want to be like that challenger brand that our customers look at, and they see us as a family business that they want to work with because we have a certain value system. So we did years of work to build this business, and they're the largest at what they do, the largest independent provider of what they do. And then they work with a marketing agency, and they came up with the family you trust, which resonates perfectly in their marketplace. So it's a perfect example of where a lot of your strategic decisions can be a foundation for a lot of the marketing decisions that need to be made after that.
I tell you, incredible insights and wisdoms that you've shared with us today, Mark. I'm going to be slicing and dicing a lot of what you said today and even deploying it with some of our own outputs. It would be a pleasure ultimately to work with you and to serve some of the strategies that you develop in outputs for our own clients. I tell you, you're a real force out there, highly, highly respected. And at one point, I tell you, one of the leading strategists in the nation and in the world, and if not still today. So we appreciate you. Thank you so much for your insights today and your wisdom. Mark Emmer, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for your appearance on StrategyCast.
Pleasure is all mine. Thank you so much.
That's a wrap. Thanks for joining us on today's show. We hope your strategic brains are spinning with new ideas and bold inspiration that will elevate your strategies and marketing know-how.